This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Private property is currently a way to monetize nature, essentially. And that's good over the short term for some people who are able to benefit from that. But it's terrible for future generations.
It's out with the old and in with, if not something completely new, something very different. This week on Sea Change Radio, we mark the end of the Trump reign of terror with a look to the future with author Richard Heinberg, a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute. We discuss his ideas for the incoming Biden administration, analyze some fundamental flaws in our current economic system, and look at the upside of the economic downturn in terms of CO2 emissions. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Richard Heinberg. He is a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute, a writer, an author, and people can read his work at richardheinberg.com and resilience.org. Richard, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
It's great to be talking with you again, Alex.
Yes, it's been a crazy year, and I don't know where to begin, but you wrote a piece this fall in September that you and I had discussed before the election. It was entitled, What If Preventing Collapse Isn't Profitable? It was part of your newsletter series on richardheinberg.com. And I thought it was a good template for us to have a larger discussion and even more germane now that we know the makeup of the Senate and who's going to be the president moving forward in this country. So why don't we first kind of talk about the three big environmental issues that could set the stage for moving forward. Let's go back, you know, to that last 40, 50 years real quickly and hit upon those bullet points.
Well, the whole environmental movement started really in the 60s and 70s with books like Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and Limits to Growth. The latter of those two actually is the best-selling environmental book of all time. So that got people to thinking about unintended consequences and limits in the environment, the limits of the climate to absorb carbon dioxide, the limits of natural resources, biodiversity limits, and so on. So the initial thrust of the environmental movement was all about, well, we need to stop doing what we're doing and do something different or do it in a different way. Economic growth has to reverse. We have to give up fossil fuels because they're polluting. And we have to reduce our population because it's growing way too fast. And we're going to bump up against all kinds of limits to, you know, everything from food to copper and fossil fuels and you name it. Policymakers did not go along with that. It was not a message that was welcome in Washington or any of the other capitals. So environmentalists went back to the drawing board and they said, well, what can we say that might have some traction? How might we make a difference? And they came up with a message that basically said, well, if we develop green technologies and we persuade environmental leaders to, you know, come up with some regulations with regard to pollution and so on, then maybe we can finesse our way out of this and we'll ignore population growth because it's just too much of a hot button issue. And we'll hope that, as we do things better, maybe population will just take care of itself somehow. If more people around the world get to sort of a middle class lifestyle, then they'll stop reproducing so much and it'll take care of itself. So that's where we've been really for the past several decades. And my essay, you know, What If Preventing Collapse Isn't Profitable, was a critique of that, saying, you know, okay, we've been doing this for the last several decades, and we have lots of profitable green opportunities, building solar panels and electric bikes and electric cars and so on, but all the problems are getting worse. So maybe it's time to rethink.
Okay, so with that in mind, a lot of people, as you write, say we could simply ignore the population issue and hope that it somehow takes care of itself as economic growth makes people more affluent and therefore likely to have fewer kids. Everybody wins. So it's similar to the clean tech silver bullet answers that we're looking for. It's like if everyone just makes a lot of money, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. And women get educated and they will fight back on having 10 kids and we'll have a downturn in this population boom.
Right. And of course, that hinges, as you say, on economic growth. You know, the whole idea of the demographic transition depends on the economy continuing to grow.
And how is that at loggerheads with the basic fundamental ideas of clean air and clean water on this planet?
Well, the way we make the economy grow is through consumerism. I mean, we've had basically a consumer economy since the 1930s. We put it in place to deal with the problem of overproduction, which was what helped create the Great Depression. So the idea was if we continually expand manufacturing and trade, then that creates more profits for industry, more returns on investments, more tax revenues for government, and more jobs for everybody else. So again, like you say, everybody wins. But consumerism is all about increasing the rate at which we are degrading nature by turning it into products that then become waste. And then somebody has to deal with that waste, and it's usually not the people who are responsible for creating it. It's usually society as a whole, or just people having to live with it, or not live with it, and if it's too toxic to live with.
Now let's fast forward from the 60s and 70s environmental movement to the 80s and 90s, and the rise of big environmental organizations and their role in shaping the policies that we're considering today.
Well, there were some key moments where there were calls for environmentalism to fundamentally change. It was clear at that time that what environmentalism was talking about wasn't being heard in the halls of power. So the suggestion was that we go from blaming industry and making people feel bad about consumption to putting a bright green coat of paint on environmentalism that would make it more attractive, to tell people that, you know, all we have to do is change the technology that we're using, and we can basically continue to enjoy the same levels of amenity and comfort that we currently do. And in fact, people like Stuart Brand, who had the Whole Earth Catalog back in the early 1970s, Stuart Brand has been one of those saying, well, you know, we actually need to take charge of the whole planet. We're almost like gods right now. And what we need to do is just get better at it. So geoengineer the planetary atmosphere and oceans to solve problems like climate change and ocean acidification. That's the only way forward. Anything else is like a retreat going back, and nobody wants to do that. We're not going to do that, so we just have to forge ahead.
And do you agree with Stuart Brand?
No, I don't.
I know that he's very vocal in his pro-nuclear stance, and we've had him on the show before. Why don't you, if you were having a kind of a mock debate right now, how would you respond to his thesis?
Well, all of the problems that we have as human beings right now, all of the big problems, I mean, you know, we've always had, people always have problems, but the survival level problems that we have now, like climate change, pollution, overpopulation, extreme inequality, all are related to power and essentially imbalances of power and too much power. People don't like to give up power, but the reality is that sometimes we have to. And take climate change, for example. We're not going to solve it simply with new technology, with low carbon energy sources. I've written extensively about that in a book I published just 3 or 4 years ago called Our Renewable Future. I did a deep dive with an energy analyst from Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory named David Fridley, and we were co-authors of this study. We looked at the opportunities and trade-offs and difficulties of transitioning the economy to zero net emissions. And our conclusion was, yeah, it can be done, but it's extraordinarily technically difficult, extraordinarily expensive. And if we hope to do it in a relatively short amount of time, like 20, 30 years, the only way that's going to work is to dramatically reduce the total amount of energy that we're using so that we have a lower bar to reach. And also, so that we don't create an enormous pulse of emissions in the process of building all those solar panels and wind turbines and other technologies. I mean, it's not just a matter of panels and turbines. We have to substitute virtually all of our transportation infrastructure, ships and planes and trains, as well as automobiles, our manufacturing infrastructure. All of that and building all of that stuff will take an enormous amount of energy, and most of that energy, at least in the initial stages, will have to come from fossil fuels. So the only way to do the energy transition realistically is to reduce our energy usage, which means giving up power. And you look at biodiversity, the same thing. We can create safe havens for endangered species and put them on lists and so on. But ultimately, what we have to do is give up land use and turn land back into wild nature, give up human activities that produce profits. So that, again, that's giving up power. And so we're reluctant to do that. I understand we're reluctant to do that, but that's the only thing that's actually going to work over the long term. And that would so that's my response to Stuart.
Now is the time for all good men to get together with one another. Out of their problems and out of their quarrels, and try to live as brothers, and try to find peace within without stepping on one another, and do respect other women of the world. Just remember, we all had mothers.
Make this land a better land and a world in which we live,
and help each man be a better man with the kindness that we give. I know we can make it. Well, we can work it out.
Yes, we can. I know we can. Yes, we can. I know we can. We if we want. Yes, we can.
I know we can make it work. I know we can make it if we try.
Oh, yes, we can. I know we can. Yes, we can. Great.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Richard Heinberg. He's an author and a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute. So, Richard, we're talking about some pretty transformative long-term ideas. We are now in a clearer place than you and I were when we were batting around ideas before the election. Now that we know how the American political system will line up for at least the next 2 years, what do you see some of the bright spots in what we can look forward to? And if you were on a council advising President Joe Biden, where would you want to try to rally the American people to make these sacrifices that you're espousing?
Well, I don't think the Biden administration is going to call for sacrifices along the lines that we've been talking about.
No, I know that. But like, what would be a clever political wedge to be able to enact some of these ideas, but without it being like like you're all going to have to give up your firstborn?
Right. Well, what I do see is that there is more understanding now that solving climate change isn't just a matter of building more solar panels and wind turbines, but it has to be an integrated approach across all the sectors of the economy, from agriculture to manufacturing to transportation to the electricity sector is really only represents about 25% of emissions. So it's all that other stuff that's really the hard work. And I think there's some recognition in Biden's team that all of that has to be tackled, and it all has to be done in an integrated way. So that's good. What I would suggest if I were in some of those meetings is that we have to start talking about degrowth in this country. It's already being discussed in Europe. It hasn't become a national policy in any country yet, but at least it's being talked about. So there's discussion about how we could reduce manufacturing, reduce resource consumption, and yet still, maintain a, coherent economy and keep people from destitution and actually improve human happiness in the process.
Yes, talking about human happiness, we've spoken before about how you think one of the quickest ways to kind of wake people up to the realities of the downsides of this endless growth model is to change the barometers for success into things like this Global Happiness Index. Why don't you expand on it if you can?
Yeah, well, gross national happiness is an idea that has been championed by the little nation of Bhutan all the way since the 1970s. And it's a great idea. It's like, well, instead of just tracking how much money is flowing through the economy as the indicator of economic well-being, which is what GDP does, why not look at what actually makes people's lives satisfactory for them? And a lot of times that's being able to spend time with one another, cultural experiences, things that really don't necessarily cost a lot of money. In fact, what we need to do over the long term is make money and profit less central to the economy and people and relationships more important to the way we organize society. So that's one thing I'd say. The other thing is, we have to look systematically at externalities and private property. And these are going to be hot button issues. Externalities are things that happen as a result of an economic process that aren't costed, that aren't paid for by the participants in that economic exchange. Pollution is usually an externality. It's the most obvious example of a negative externality where nobody sets out to pollute. It's a byproduct. It's an unintended consequence of resource extraction, manufacturing, and so on. And we usually leave most of the mess for somebody else to clean up, or the next generation to clean up, or whatever. Well, we have to, the idea of internalizing externalities has been around for a long time, but we really have to take that seriously with regard to, right now, everybody dumps carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and somebody's going to pay for that eventually. Not the people who are doing the dumping. So we benefit, and especially industries and companies benefit now from dumping carbon dioxide, but they don't have to pay to clean it up. Now, if we got rid of externalities, that would reduce profits for all kinds of industries. It would reduce overall profits in the economy. That's one of the reasons we have to make profit less central to the economy as a whole. Then ownership. I'm not talking about your ability to own your house or your gardening tools or whatever. What I'm talking about is the ability of a corporation to buy a piece of land that happens to have coal or some other resource, a forest or a copper or whatever underneath, and extract those resources and obtain the economic benefit from those resources, but not have to answer for the depletion of those resources for future generations. Private property is currently a way to monetize nature, essentially. And that's good over the short term for some people who are able to benefit from that, but it's terrible for future generations. So we have to rethink that aspect of private property also. So I would try to get those conversations going, and they're kind of radioactive for a lot of folks on the political right, but sooner or later we got to deal with them.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Richard Heinberg. He's an author and a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute. So, Richard, we haven't spoken since the pandemic broke out last March, and a lot of these issues that we're discussing are coming into play, whether we like it or not. Consumer spending is down, transportation is down. A lot of these changes or sacrifices that we may have written about or read about before the pandemic are happening, whether we like it or not. And, you know, millions of people dead, 400,000 Americans dead. This is not what anybody really hoped for, but there are lessons to be taken from it. And are there some silver linings for the end of endless growth from a policy standpoint that we could maybe glean from this episode in human history?
Sure. I think there are. We reduced carbon emissions in the U.S. by about 10% in 2020. That's stunning. We have never reduced emissions simply as a result of, you know, building more solar panels and wind turbines or, you know, creating more government regulations. The only thing that has resulted in lowering emissions is reducing GDP, actually, reducing the velocity of the economy. So we know that actually works. If we need to reduce emissions, we know how to do it. We have the proof. Now, yes, it's true that what happened in 2020 was miserable. Nobody wants a repeat of that or to, you know, keep doing that for the long term. But that reduction in economic activity was not planned, and it wasn't for the purpose of degrowth. It wasn't for the purpose of increasing human happiness while decreasing environmental harm. It was a slapdash affair that was undertaken for an entirely different purpose, which was, of course, to prevent the pandemic from killing millions of Americans. So we could do a lot better job of degrowth if we set our minds to it and if we agreed that that's a priority. If that's what we set out to do, then we could plan it and using policy tools, using communication tools, by creating a national consensus and making it a goal that we can work together toward, I think we could accomplish much, much more. And in fact, I think that's the only way we're going to get there. Sure, we do need green technology. I don't want anyone to listen to this and think that I'm completely opposed to any kind of technological change. That's certainly not the case. But technology by itself is not going to solve any of these survival level problems, whether it's climate change, loss of biodiversity, extreme economic inequality, resource depletion. All of these are going to require changes in attitude and changes in behavior.
And for those who have been preaching that we need this endless growth to keep the American economic machine alive, and that's in their minds often reflected in the Dow Jones and the stock market. Right. Stock market has been humming along quite well despite this economic downturn and despite having rather insane leader at the helm. What does that say to you?
One of the problems of the way we've attacked the coronavirus pandemic over the last few months is that it has generated more economic inequality. And again, you know, if we're going to solve these problems, we have to do it together, which means reducing inequality. We've used GDP growth as a way to help people, or as a way to encourage people, is a better way to say it, to go along with increasing inequality. Increasing inequality is a normal feature of an expanding social system.
So that's really what this stock market boom is reflecting, is an increased stratification.
Exactly. Yeah. And so the what we've done with economic growth is we've said, well, eventually everybody is going to be better off, even though some people will be much, much better off. And so it's okay. You'll be taken care of too. But if the economy stops growing, if we have degrowth, as we actually have had a little bit of over the last year, then the people at the bottom of the economic pyramid really suffer.
And so what's the danger of the green profit narrative within this discussion? I mean, a lot of people would say profit is not the problem, it's the type of profit. It's why can't we get people working in a much healthier type of economy? Where do you see the downside there?
Well, I'm not against all profits. I mean, people need to have enterprises, whether it's small farms or local manufacturing or building solar panels. But as we were talking about earlier, most profits are tied to externalities and private ownership of natural resources. And when we deal with externalities and private ownership of public resources, when we change the dynamics of those things, what we're going to end up doing is reducing the profitability of a great deal of industry. And a lot of industries will just go away, including the fossil fuel industries and everything that's related to them. That's a big deal. That's a big part of the economy and the way the economy works right now. So that's why I say, circling back around, we have to make money and profit less central to our lives and less central to the way the country works, the way the world works.
Well, it's always a refreshing and illuminating discussion. I really appreciate you coming on the show, Richard. You're working on a new book, and it should be out by the end of the summer or so, and I hope we can have you back on then. Richard Heinberg, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It's a delight, Alex. Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Chris Joss and Lee Dorsey.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.